document that you drew up dictating to the press the rules for the coverage of the war in Afghanistan. There will be not more than one report of a death or wound per month among Soviet servicemen. And what of this document in which the Politburo approves of the creation of a news bureau for Komsomolskaya Pravda in Canada, and stipulates that the resident correspondent be an officer of the KGB? What of it? Ligachev said. This is a practice broadly implemented by other countries. And what of the Politburo decision to create a special military unit of the KGB, manned by people infinitely loyal to the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the Socialist Motherland? Isn't it curious that the party, which had allegedly relinquished the one-party system, could still dictate such a policy to a government ministry? "Well, I am sure there was no ill will intended," Ligachev said. "And what of this document, esteemed Yegor Kuzmich? A Politburo session on March 24, 1987, at which the members agree that permissions given for business trips abroad must be tightened up, because, as they say, we regret that only professional competence is being taken into account, and not political concerns." "What's wrong with that?" he answered. "That just means that we were not indifferent to how people behaved abroad, moral factors included." Finally, after a long day at the witnesses' lectern, Ligachev began to show flashes of why he was feared by the hundreds of men and women working in the Central Committee apparatus. For years he had been the one asking the tough questions, not answering them, and now he, like Rizhkov, snapped. "Look," he said, "if we'd taken decisive measures at the beginning, this country would not be on fire as it is today. This war is not only close to Russia, it is entering our own homes. It is here. Mikhail Sergeyevich took decisions only when every last citizen in the country knew they were necessary, when every last apple had ripened and fallen from the tree." After a few days of watching the testimony at the Constitutional Court, I found it remarkable that there was hardly any interest at all among the public. The spectators' gallery was nearly empty. Some days there were no more than 5 or 6 journalists around. Nearly all the regulars, the true court buffs, were themselves dinosaurs of the Communist Party. For nearly everyone else, the struggles and pleasures of the present were of far greater concern. For Moscow now, little more than a year after the coup, had become a phantasmagoria, a post-communist world as painted by Hieronymus Bosch. Younger Muscovites especially seemed determined to rush headlong into some weird, pleasurable, vulgar world of primitive capitalism. In a leap typical of all Russian history, the new economy had bounded from one stage of development to the next, gliding quickly from complete deficit to sensual indulgence, never stopping to solve the mundane problems of subsistence, structure, and property. In the subway stations and the kiosks, you could buy a lace tablecloth, a bottle of Curacao, Wrigley spearmint gum, Mars bars, a Public Enemy tape, Swiss chocolate, plastic marital toys, a Mercedes-Benz hood ornament, American cigarettes, and Estonian pornography. In the alleyways and restaurants, Moscow was beginning to look like the set of Once Upon a Time in America. As the old Communist Party mafia structures withered, more conventional ones took their place. The city was awash with 25-year-old men wearing slick suits and black shirts and announcing their occupation as a little buying, a little selling. Their malls dressed in spandex and fox. A kiosk owner's failure to pay his weekly protection money usually left him with a kiosk reduced to sticks and broken glass. As hyperinflation drove the ruble into irrelevance, a system of financial apartheid arrived. The dollar, suffering everywhere else, was supreme in Russia. Every day more foreign business executives arrived at Sheremetyevo Airport, toting their briefcases like pickaxes and pans, hoping to find the new Klondike. In the meantime, they were also the new colonials, hiring servants and snapping up Russian antiques for a song. In the house on the embankment, the swank home of the nomenklatura a half-century ago, the former apartment of Stalin's chief executioner was now occupied by the top executive of McDonald's. There was no nostalgia or reverence for the old dogma. At the biggest bookstore in the city, the House of Books, I saw a weary sales clerk using a stack of the collected works of V.I. Lenin as a stool while he handed out copies of the latest editions of Agatha Christie and Arthur Haley. Moscow had become a city of disorientation, so much so that you could easily take a wrong turn into the 19th century. A former journalist named Vadim Dormidontov sat in an office at Moscow City Hall and decided which streets and neighborhoods would lose their Soviet-era names and regain their old ones. Lenin Hills was Sparrow Hills once more. The residents of Ustinov Boulevard now lived again on Autumn Boulevard. While nearly everyone tried to get his bearings in this strange new world, Yeltsin struggled with a hard-line opposition more than willing to exploit the collapse of the economy for its political gain. The coalition of conservatives was often known as the Red and Browns, the alliance of former Communist Party bosses and ultra-nationalists, even neo-fascists. For Yeltsin, the trial was a critical front in the battle to stave off the reactionaries. "The so-called Red and Brown forces are advancing," he said on the eve of the trial. "I would say that today Russia's destiny depends on the Constitutional Court rather than on the President. Any support for the Communists may play into their hands and promote their destructive activity, which may push us into a civil war." In Moscow now, hardly any politician dared refer to himself as a Democrat, for fear of appearing too Western, too liberal, incompetent. Some of the leaders of the radical reform movement tried to broaden their political appeal by playing, however cautiously, the nationalist card. Sergei Stankovich, the young advisor to Yeltsin, had begun his political career in 1989 as a radical Democrat, and now referred to himself as a statist Democrat. He wanted a little nationalist shading to broaden his political base. Yeltsin, too, had to emphasize his national feeling, making fast friends with the hierarchy of the Russian Orthodox Church and refusing to make a deal with the Japanese on the Kuril Islands. Yeltsin realized that it was hard for Russians to lose all the time, lose territory, power, influence, and count it as victory. But the radical right was not impressed with Yeltsin's guile. He was considered the chief culprit in the fracturing of the Soviet state and the fragmentation of Russia itself. The historian Yuri Afanasyev, a deputy now in the Russian parliament, told me he thought the Russian scene was one of dangerous flux. "The old system will never regain its shape, but all kinds of possibilities exist for the future of Russia," he said. "We could look like South Korea, or, say, Latin America with a taint of Sicily. It is a far from sure thing that we will resemble the developed Western democracies. The pull of the state sector, the authoritarian tug, is still a very dangerous thing. Fascism, in the form of National Socialism, is a major threat. And it is finding supporters not only in the lunatic fringe, but in the alleged center. The Russian consciousness has always been flawed by a yearning for expansion and a fear of contraction. Unfortunately, the history of Russia is the history of growth. This is a powerful image in the Russian soul, the idea of breadth as wealth. The more, the better. But the truth is that such expansion has always depleted Russian power and wealth. Berdyaev was right when he said that Russia was always crippled by its expanse. To some degree, the Communist Party's myth-making machinery had been replaced by Russian nostalgia for a pre-revolutionary utopia that never was. Stanislav Govorukhin's 1992 film The Russia We Lost portrayed the last Tsar, previously considered a dolt and a weakling in communist propaganda, as a man of great learning, military skill, and compassion. Lenin is a slit-eyed fanatic with pathological obsessions and, naturally, Jewish forebears. Govorukhin told the newspaper, Megapolis Express, that were there to be another putsch, he would not rush to the White House to defend the popularly elected government as he had during the August coup. Following a totalitarian regime, he said, a sea of democracy and freedom is a safe road to fascism. His credo now was the famous declaration of the Tsarist reformer Pyotr Stolypin to the Russian Duma. You want great upheavals, but what we need is a great Russia.
Although there were only a half dozen people in the Moskva theater when I went to see The Russia We Lost, and while the opinion polls did not indicate a great public longing for an overthrow of the Yeltsin government, Moscow seemed filled with demagogues who would be czar.
The first to appear on the scene was Vladimir Zhirinovsky, an unabashed neo-fascist who won 6 million votes, almost 8% of the electorate, in June 1991, when he ran against Yeltsin and four other candidates for the Russian presidency. Just after the coup, I watched Zhirinovsky at a parliamentary session at the Kremlin deliver 2-hour-long monologues to clumps of fascinated deputies in the corridors. He rambled on, picking up so much speed as he described his imperial ambitions that he showered his listeners and the television cameras with little sprays of spit. I'll start by squeezing the Baltics and other small nations. I don't care if they are recognized by the UN. I'm not going to invade them or anything. I'll bury radioactive waste along the Lithuanian border and put up powerful fans and blow the stuff across the border at night. I'll turn the fans off during the day. They'll all get radiation sickness. They'll die of it. When they either die out or get down on their knees, I'll stop it. I'm a dictator. What I'm going to do is bad, but it'll be good for Russia. The Slavs are going to get anything they want if I'm elected. I will send troops to Afghanistan again, and this time they'll win. I will restore the foreign policy of the Tsars. I won't make Russians fight. I'll make Uzbeks and Tajiks do the fighting. Russian officers will just give the orders, like Napoleon. Uzbeks, forward to Kabul. And when the Uzbeks are all dead, it'll be Tajiks, forward to Kabul. The Bashkirs can go to Mongolia, where there's TB and syphilis. The other republics will be Russia's kitchen garden. Russia will be the brains. I say it quite plainly, when I come to power, there will be a dictatorship. I will beat the Americans in space. I will surround the planet with our space stations so that they'll be scared of our space weapons. I don't care if they call me a fascist or a Nazi. Workers in Leningrad told me, even if you wear 5 swastikas, we'll vote for you all the same. You promise a clear plan. There's nothing like fear to make people work better. The stick, not the carrot. I'll do it all without tanks on the streets. Those who have to be arrested will be arrested quietly at night. I may have to shoot 100,000 people, but the other 300 million will live peacefully. I have the right to shoot these 100,000. I have this right as president.
Despite his surprisingly strong showing in the last Russian presidential race, the vast majority of people believed Zhirinovsky was either mad, an agent of the secret police, or both. But he was not alone in his extremism. Alexander Sterlegov, a former KGB colonel who promised the Iron Hand, was only the latest in a collection of would-be dictators who were hoping the public would grow so disenchanted with the Yeltsin government that it would turn to them. One afternoon on my trip in the fall of 1992, I visited the grungy editorial offices of Dien, the newspaper that was now one of the leading voices of the hard-right coalition. Just weeks before the August coup, Jian published the infamous Word to the People, the front-page appeal for a military seizure of power. I met with the author of the appeal and the editor of the paper, Alexander Prokhanov, and his deputy, Vladimir Bondarenko. Bondarenko told me he had just returned from the United States, a trip, he said, that was sponsored in part by David Duke, the former Nazi and Ku Klux Klansman. "Perhaps Duke's views are a bit extreme," Bondarenko allowed. "I suppose my views are better compared to those of your Patrick Buchanan." We talked a long time about the coup, and here, too, the conservatives spoke of the putsch as a shadow play, something that was not what it seemed. When people heard about the putsch, most of them said, "Finally, at last, they are doing what they have to do," Bondarenko said. They did not believe in terror, but they wanted elementary order, the sort of order that states have everywhere. But the leaders of the coup were so stupid. They are to be condemned, not because they pulled off a coup, but because they did it so stupidly. Prokhanov, a performance artist of the right wing, made Bondarenko seem almost rational. "You did it," he said, pointing at me as the representative American. "You did it." "And how do I know? I have friends at Langley, at the State Department, and at the Rand Institute. The general concept was yours, the CIA's, I am sure of it. The process was regulated and designed by your people. The so-called leaders of the coup were pushed forward and then betrayed. They were left to be torn to pieces by the public opinion. They were so stupid to have believed Gorbachev." In this whole drama, only the CIA was smart. They alone knew that the Soviet Union would fall apart under the concept of republican sovereignty, an idea they planted in the Baltics and then elsewhere. Do you think East Germany fell apart on its own? Do you think Poland, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, and finally the Soviet Union fell apart on their own? The plan of struggle against the Soviet Union has existed ever since World War II. Prokhanov said he was elated on the first morning of the coup, and disgusted when it collapsed 3 days later. But he said he was sure that his time would come again. After a year in which the government has lost trust and the Democrats are in a state of collapse, the patriots from the left and the right will come together and the war will continue. And it will be, I assure you, an anti-American movement. There are three ways we can come to power, and we will use any means to do it. First, we can do it in Parliament. Second, there can be a split within the government and the liberals lose the support of the army, the new KGB, and there is a gradual drift to the right. Or we can do it through extra-governmental means, strikes, demonstrations, general chaos. In any case, the Yeltsin people should not relax. The trial shoved ahead. Interest dwindled even further. "Society is sick of history," Arseny Roginsky of the Memorial Historical Society told me. "It is too much with us. For people trying to cope with crazy inflation and adjusting to a new economy in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, it's a natural psychological situation. People do have some sense that their current troubles are tied to the history of the party, but it is not always easy to step back and see that." The only aspect of the trial of the Communist Party that was grabbing any space in the newspapers and on the evening news was the question of Mikhail Gorbachev's refusal to testify. Chief Justice Zorkin insisted from the start that Gorbachev's testimony, as General Secretary of the Party from March 1985 until August 1991, was essential. In Zorkin's summons, however, Gorbachev saw only the invisible hand of Boris Yeltsin and another attempt to humiliate him. The two men had been playing out their opera of rivalry and unconscious cooperation for so long that Muscovites had wearied of it. As part of his retirement package, Gorbachev got from Yeltsin a dacha, bodyguards, a pension, and a fine piece of real estate, the former Party Institute on Leningrad Prospect. Gorbachev, for his part, said he would use the Institute as a base for research, not political opposition. But détente, such as it was, collapsed quickly. Gorbachev began accusing Yeltsin of running a government not dissimilar to an insane asylum, and Yeltsin's aides began chipping away at Gorbachev's retirement deal, first taking away his limousine and replacing it with a more modest sedan, then threatening worse. Soon, one newspaper cracked, Mikhail Sergeyevich will be going to work on a bicycle. During the trial, I went to see Gorbachev at his institute, hoping to talk about many things besides the furor over his refusal to testify. There was no chance of that. He had already been fined 100 rubles by the court, around 30 cents at the time, and he knew well that more sanctions were on the way. After he greeted me, he plopped himself down into an armchair, saying with false cheer, "They are running around like mad. They all got into this shit, and they don't know what to do now." Gorbachev was furious, obsessed. I asked a question, and he finished his answer 40 minutes later, an answer that was part set piece, part harangue. I had spent many hours while living in Moscow listening to Gorbachev at press conferences, summits, interviews, meetings, and he was never one for concision. But now he seemed at times like Lear raging about plots against his underappreciated self. He truly believed that the court's summons amounted to political persecution of the most heinous sort. "Even Stalin's sick mind could not have dreamed up anything like this," Gorbachev said. "To rule that 18 million communists be deprived of their citizenship and swept away. Not just simply to deprive them, but sweep them away with a broom. And with their families, we are talking about 50 to 70 million people. Only a lunatic would do this. If you call yourselves Democrats, prove it with your deeds." Gorbachev had enough courage always to tell the truth to everyone and endure the pressure. "I've got plenty of courage, and even now I will not yield." "What is this? A constitutional court? There is no court in the world that can judge history. It is up to history proper to judge history, historians, scholars, and so on. Will the court go all the way back to the October Revolution, to the Bolsheviks, or even earlier? Will they anathematize it all? Is this the business of the constitutional court? Let's analyze what Lenin did to take power. Does this mean that all the countries that cooperated with Soviet Russia and all the agreements that were made, do they all go? Pfft! Is it all rubbish? Unconstitutional? God knows what this all is. You don't have to be too bright to understand what this process is likely to lead to." Somewhere along the way, I managed to ask Gorbachev if he kept in contact with Yeltsin any longer. Gorbachev frowned. He was being ignored. This seemed to him worse than any sanction of the court. "He never calls me," Gorbachev said. "I called him several times at first, but from his side there has never been a call. Boris Nikolaevich knows everything. We have no relations. What kind of personal relations can there be when his press secretary publishes a statement saying that they will take measures against Gorbachev, that they will put him in his place? What relations can there be? This is ruled out. The Democrats have failed to use their power. Look at how they struggled for power and how much they promised. There were even statements that the Russian president would lay himself down across the railroad tracks if living standards went down. Well, now they've gone down 50%. The tracks must be occupied. They have to tell the people how they are going to get through the winter, what there will be to eat, whether there will be any heat, and what will happen to reforms. And they have no answer. They don't know what to say. They need to play for time, and they need to find a lightning rod. It's amazing. Yeltsin's team, the Constitutional Court, and the fundamentalists who defended against the August coup are all in this struggle together against Gorbachev. This is phenomenal. I left Gorbachev's office thinking that everything about him was outsize. His achievements, his mistakes, and now his vanity and bitterness. At one point in his monologue, he even passed on a rumor that at the tensest moments of the coup, Yeltsin had been making plans to hide in the American embassy. This was hard, if not impossible, to believe. For all of Yeltsin's shortcomings, it was his courage that won the day in August of 1991. Gorbachev, in suggesting otherwise, especially in such a dark and clumsy way, revealed the depths of his bitterness. He had loved his place in the world, a place he had earned despite all the mistakes, and now it seemed it was slipping away, almost gone. He was despised in his own country. Feeling a little stunned, I left Gorbachev and headed down a flight of stairs to visit the man who had been his closest friend and ally in the leadership, Alexander Yakovlev. I told Yakovlev what I had just heard, and he rolled his eyes in amusement and frustration. Yakovlev had always betrayed a certain intellectual condescension for Gorbachev, but he also appreciated his political gifts, his complexity. I told Yakovlev I had finally seen the transcript of the historic March 11, 1985 Politburo meeting, and I was a little surprised that things had gone so easily for Gorbachev. Why had there been no opposition? And had Gorbachev been deceiving the conservatives? Why had they made him general secretary if they knew he would try to change the system? There was a preliminary agreement, Yakovlev said. Everything was agreed on beforehand. Everything was clear. Grishin's entourage prepared a speech, a program for him. Richard Kosolapov, the editor of Communist, was very active on Grishin's behalf. But that was just in case. In fact, there were no other candidates for this position. Once Gorbachev was made chairman of the funeral commission for Chernenko's funeral on March 10th, everything was clear. But about deception. This was really a question of the inertia of the Communist Party. Every new general secretary got carte blanche at the beginning. A new man would come to the fore and he was supported. You know, let him talk about innovations, about something new. It has to be tolerated. And then he will calm down and everything will go back to normal. Let him talk about democracy and pluralism. But, sooner or later, we'll all be back together harnessed to the same horse cart. That happened with every newcomer, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Andropov. And the same destiny was expected of Gorbachev. Gorbachev played politics, but he also realized that things had to change. It was impossible to go on living as we were. But when he started changing things, the system resisted those reforms. These changes were hindered by the simple logic of the state. And whether he wanted to or not, Gorbachev had to deal with these contradictions. Like Gorbachev at the beginning, I believed that in our country, only a revolution from above was possible. Even now Gorbachev talks about our socialist choice. But we cannot speak of a socialist choice in this country. Our experience, our choice, is not socialist and never was. We had a slave system here. Who can talk about a socialist choice? Maybe Germany, or Israel, or Spain, but not us. But Gorbachev could not overcome his mentality. In general, this power, the concept of power, acts like a poison on a person. During my talk with Gorbachev, his press aide, Alexander Likhotal, had slipped him a note. Gorbachev went silent, read the note quickly, darkened with what seemed to be anger, composed himself, and then picked up the long string of his monologue. I didn't think much of it then. But later that evening, as I watched the evening news show Vesti, I realized what the note must have said. For his refusal to appear in court, he was being deprived of his right to travel abroad. He had a trip planned to South Korea, and there were more on the schedule. That was a cruel and clever blow. Gorbachev was endlessly applauded abroad. He was treated as one of the great figures of the century. In Moscow, he was punished, mocked, and ignored.
3 days later, the Russian government announced it would take back most of the building it had given Gorbachev as part of his resignation package. On a cool gray morning, 3 buses filled with Moscow police officers pulled up to the institute. The police chief, Arkady Murashev, ordered his men to surround the building. Just minutes later, Gorbachev arrived in a rage. The press gathered around him on the front steps of the building. "You don't know the pressure that my family and I have endured in the past 7 years," he told the reporters. "But personal matters are not the thing. They are trying to put Gorbachev in his place. The Russian press speculates that Gorbachev is traveling the world looking for a vacation house. There's the rumor that my daughter is in Germany and her husband is to join her there. Or America. And now that he has a daughter settled, Gorbachev is looking for a warm place for himself. Well, they'd be very happy if Gorbachev left the country. They'd probably pay $1 million for it. But I'm not leaving." A few miles away, the Constitutional Court heard its next witness. The tired men of the Communist Party protested their innocence. "How could we have been what you charge?" they seemed to say. "Just look at us. We are plain. We are ordinary. We are nobody now." A few weeks later, the Constitutional Court of Russia ruled that communists were free to meet on a local level, but the Communist Party, as a national entity, was illegal. The party's assets and properties remained under the control of the elected government of the Russian Federation. The era that had begun in 1917 with the Bolshevik coup had now ended in a court of law. Afterword to the Vintage Edition. The heart is not yet joyful. From the first moment that Mikhail Gorbachev began his frenetic tinkering with the Soviet system, time, and the perception of time, lost its normal rhythm. Every year seems like an entire era. So many triumphs, agonies, and bitter surprises register on the landscape of the old empire that it is hard to focus on anything more distant than the previous week, much less on that Christmas night in 1991, when Gorbachev signed his resignation papers and the red flag over the Kremlin was lowered for the last time. But even now I cannot forget that time. As Gorbachev was preparing his departure, I went to the Kremlin to see one of his most loyal aides, Georgi Shaknazarov. Like Gorbachev, Shaknazarov had hoped to reform communism, to rescue the system and drag it into the modern world. That project, the last lingering dream of socialism, turned out to be folly. Now the regime was in ruins and the empire in dissolution. All the talk was of a democracy and a free market. Gorbachev had passed into history, and the movers were coming to cart away the boxes. "How will all these republics survive without Moscow?" Shaknazarov said. He was a gnomish man, half scholar, half apparatchik, and now he looked resigned, withered. "What will become of them? What will a republic like Georgia do? Do you think they'll get any oil selling mandarin oranges to Saudi Arabia? And Armenia and Azerbaijan, don't you think they will be at each other's throats?" Shaknazarov's desk was bare, but for one single-spaced letter he was leaving behind for the next occupant, whoever that might turn out to be. "I'm just letting him know I wish them all luck," Shaknazarov said. "They're going to need it." In the more than 2 years since, Russia and the former Soviet republics have surely not been blessed with anywhere near the amount of luck they have needed. Nor have they always had the wisdom or the means to avoid economic and political disaster. One can only begin to count up the mounting catastrophes in the old Soviet Union. The collapsed economies,
the troubling diaspora of 25 million Russians in foreign lands, the threat of nuclear accidents and ecological ruin, the rise of a hardline Russian nationalist, and the astonishing persistence of various communist parties. In retrospect, Boris Yeltsin wishes that he had acted even more quickly and decisively in the wake of the August coup. While he still had the political support, he should have dissolved Parliament and called for elections, thereby avoiding the disastrous 2-year-long confrontation with Parliament that led to the bloody storming of the White House in October 1993. But history is unforgiving. It does not accommodate the words, "if only." On my last trip to Moscow, toward the end of 1993, everywhere I went, from the central market to the villages outside of town, from newspaper offices to Kremlin anterooms where aides sat dully around, watching music videos, there was a sense of drift, even hopelessness, about political life. The October events, and then the dispiriting December elections, which brought into the new parliament dozens of ultra-nationalists and communists, obliterated any shred of triumphalism left over from the defeat of the August coup of 1991. The relatively easy verities of the old political struggle, good versus bad, reformers versus reactionaries, Democrats versus communists, had dissolved into a bitter soup of uncertainty. The December elections confirmed the despair among Russians, as nearly 25% voted for the ultra-nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky, more as a protest against the squalid status quo than as an endorsement of his mad program of aggression abroad and the iron fist at home. Nearly half the electorate did not bother voting. Much of the opposition to Yeltsin is rooted in one form or another of mythic nostalgia. The communist nostalgia for the order of Stalin and the supposedly dependable standard of living under Brezhnev. The military nostalgia for the fear the Soviet arsenal once struck in the heart of the Western enemy. The nationalist nostalgia for empire and higher spiritual purpose. It is natural, all too human, that nostalgia should be such a powerful force of politics now in Russia, just as it was for the Ottomans and the British as they lost their hold on the earth. Empires are not lost happily. Enoch Powell was driven to fits of poetry over the loss of India, and even today, neo-Ottomanism is a powerful force in Turkish politics. For tens of millions of Russians, the story of their country since Gorbachev's advent in 1985 has been one of unremitting loss and wounded pride. What took decades for the citizens of Constantinople and London to absorb struck the Russians in an instant. The empire has vanished. That the economy has been dying is obvious to any Western visitor. Less obvious is the Russian's anxiety about his place in the world. The jewels of empire are lost. The beaches of the Crimea, the vineyards of Moldova, the oil fields of Kazakhstan, the ports of Odessa. To say nothing of Prague, Budapest, and Warsaw, are all within foreign lands now. The army is fraught with draft dodging and erosion. Foreign policy is a roadmap of retreat. A leading sociologist in Moscow, Yuri Levada, recently published a poll in the daily newspaper Izvestia, showing that only 11% of the population believe that Russia is still a great power, while 2/3 of the respondents said that the country should regain its lost prestige on the world stage. Between those two statistics is a great longing, a feeling of national loss and anxiety. And that longing, as much as the failing economy, is a lethal weapon in the hands of Yeltsin's political opponents. While Yeltsin and his supporters are trying to create, all at once, a market economy, a democratic political system, and a civil society, his hardline opponents, more often than not, indulge in a politics of loss, a new sort of populism. Many influential liberals in politics, such as Yeltsin's former advisor Galina Staravatova, feel that Russia's economic failure and wounded self-esteem are so profound and combustible that the rise of a charismatic authoritarian movement in Russia cannot be ruled out. One cannot exclude the possibility of a fascist period in Russia, Staravoitova said on the radio station Echo of Moscow. We can see too many parallels between Russia's current situation and that of Germany after the Versailles Treaty. A great nation is humiliated, and many of its nationals live outside the country's borders. The disintegration of an empire has taken place at a time when many people still have an imperialist mentality. All this is happening at a time of economic crisis. In his campaign for parliament, Vladimir Zhirinovsky played on the feelings of humiliation in the post-Great Power era and spoke in a rhetoric of stark simplicity and darkest comedy. Jews, Central Asians, Armenians, and Azerbaijanis should be driven from positions of power. Only people with kind Russian faces should appear on Russian television. He declared himself willing to blow up a few Kuwaiti ports and aircraft, plus a few American ships, to defend the old Soviet ally, Iraq. And should the Japanese press their demands for the Kuril Islands, I would bomb the Japanese. I would sail our large navy around their small island, and if they so much as cheaped, I would nuke them. As if this were not enough, he promised everything from a magical end to the economic crisis to love and romance for the lonely. The pro-reform Democrats, for their part, gave Zhirinovsky his opening. They were smug and divided, nearly oblivious to the fact that they were doing nothing to build support for radical economic reforms that have proved painful to millions of people. Zhirinovsky's triumph was a warning. Russia and the world cannot afford a President Zhirinovsky. If Russia was ever under any illusions about its being a democratic country, it is no longer. In conversations with Yeltsin's aides, all of them admitted that the illusion of a smooth and swift transfer from a communist dictatorship to a free market democracy is gone. It turns out that the fall of the old regime, which had been so morally satisfying, has left the new regime in an impossible moral position. The choice is stark. Behave with the manners of a Western democrat and allow the current anarchy to overwhelm Russia, or take decisive measures and risk flouting any semblance of civil society. Now the talk is of a transitional regime of enlightened authoritarianism, or guided democracy, or some such hybrid that makes no secret of the need for a prolonged concentration of power in the presidency. The hand of power cannot be totally weak, Yeltsin's legal adviser, Yuri Baturin, told me one afternoon at the Kremlin. When the use of power was necessary during the October events, it was impossible to use it right away because the so-called power ministries, defense, security, police, were hesitating. Had they used their force more quickly, it would have been accomplished sooner, with less blood. But Yeltsin's advisers also admit that in trying to restore some degree of order in Russia, there is a constant danger of an imperceptible drift into the traditional habit of iron rule. Like Gorbachev's perestroika, everything now in the development of democracy is being guided only from above, said Georgi Satarov, a member of the Presidential Council. It is very easy to slip into dictatorship. There are no checks. Monopolistic rule is responsible for checking itself. And this self-restriction has to hold somehow before there are real checks and balances. There can be little steps toward dictatorship, each one seeming small in and of itself. But the trend can drag us into dictatorship. This can happen. But so far as I know the president and his motives, I do not think he has any intention of becoming a dictator. There are more than enough people who have called on Yeltsin to become an unabashed autocrat, A poll published recently in Izvestia showed that 3/4 of all Muscovites welcomed the brief state of emergency that followed the October events and wanted to see it prolonged indefinitely. But even if Yeltsin were inclined to become the leader of a full-scale authoritarian regime, and he is not, he wouldn't be able to manage it. Although some of his advisers point to South Korea and parts of Latin America as places that built potential democracies under authoritarian rule, the analogy falls flat before Russian realities. Despite the military's decisive role in October 1993, the army has no Latin American-style ambitions for hunterdom. The generals would much rather win higher wages and other social guarantees than take the upper hand in politics. Nor can Russia rely on an Asian work ethic or efficiency, to say nothing of a democratic political culture, a feature of life in Chile before Pinochet. Russia has to make democracy with Russians. The truth is that Yeltsin, or any other leader who emerges as his potential successor, has the near impossible task of trying to build a democracy in conditions of social and economic anarchy. Alexander Rutskoy and Ruslan Khasbulatov may be in jail after their failed grab for power in October 1993, but theirs is not likely to be the last episode of rebellion or violence. Even those who accept, or at least are resigned to Yeltsin's notion of transition, understand that the anger and disillusionment throughout Russian society is growing ever worse. The dulling realities of Soviet society, equality and poverty, the stability of repression, have come unwound, and now Russia is a scene of radical polarization. The fondest wish of the Russian reformers in 1991 was that out of economic change would emerge a huge middle class and a business elite that would become the main constituencies for further change. There are no signs of this happening. Instead, Russians have watched with fury and envy as a handful of people have grown rich, gaudily rich, amid growing chaos and criminality. Capitalism in Russia has spawned far more Al Capones than Henry Fords. Reform is not a period of retreat. There is not a single field of activity, not a single institution, free of the most brutal sort of corruption. Russia has bred a world-class mafia. According to Luciano Violante, chairman of Italy's Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry into the Mafia, Russia is now a kind of strategic capital of organized crime from where all the major operations are launched. He said that Russian mob leaders have held summits with the 3 main Italian crime organizations from Sicily, Calabria, and Naples to discuss drug money laundering, narcotics trade, and even the sale of nuclear material. Russia, he added, has become a warehouse and clearinghouse for the drug market. The new Russian mobsters, who are into everything from arms sales to banking, have learned to work with former officials in the highest ranks of the Communist Party and the KGB, as well as mob bosses abroad. There is also little doubt that the ministries of Yeltsin's government, especially in areas like foreign trade, customs, tax collection and law enforcement, are thoroughly corrupt. According to Yuri Boldyrev, until recently the government's chief investigator, the corruption in state and public institutions now goes beyond the limits of the imagination. A 10-page report drafted by the police and security ministries and submitted to Yeltsin in 1993 described how senior military officers based for years in the former East Germany have been involved in huge embezzlement schemes. The officers set up their own companies to buy food and liquor, had them transported as military supplies, and then sold them on the free market in Poland and Russia. Sales were estimated at 100 million Deutschmarks, $58 million. In another case, Air Force Major General Vladimir Rodionov and his deputy, Colonel Georgi Iskrov, were charged with using military aircraft for commercial flights and keeping the proceeds. Yeltsin has not been averse to admitting what is before the eyes of everyone. According to a report by Viktor Yasmin of Radio Liberty, Yeltsin told the heads of the central and regional law enforcement agencies that 2/3 of all commercial and financial enterprises in Russia and 40% of individual businessmen were engaged in some form of corruption. He said in 1992 that $2 billion had simply disappeared from the budget of the Ministry of Foreign Economic Relations. Even the anti-mafia investigators are suspect. One of the chiefs of the Interior Ministry was arrested in 1993 for taking a 1 million ruble bribe. A subsequent search of his home found another 805,000 rubles in cash. Foreigners trying to do business in Russia have become easy targets. A friend told me about a Westerner who was caught in traffic in Moscow, and as he inched along, lightly touched the bumper of the car ahead of him. A man dressed mainly in jewelry and leather leaped from the car, ran up to the foreigner's window, stuck a revolver in, and said, "Buy my car now or I will kill you." The foreigner, an experienced resident of Moscow, knew well that this mafioso was not joking. He went home, gathered up all the cash he could find, and bought the car. The following week, the same unfortunate man was traveling to St. Petersburg on the midnight train. Someone drugged him, and when he woke up in the morning, all his valuables were gone. Such crimes shock no one in the West, but they are an ominous novelty in Russia. Law enforcement, too, is a bitter joke. Mobsters at every level have more troops and more powerful weapons than the police. Army officers and recruits, desperate for cash, are only too glad to sell guns, rocket launchers, and grenades to the highest bidder. It is not unknown for members of mafia gangs in southern Russia to use a tank to settle an especially stubborn account. And at a time when nearly everyone is impoverished, including police, jailers, and judges, the likelihood of successful prosecution is minuscule. Vladimir Rushailo, chief of the Moscow Police Department, said, "Even if we manage to jail an influential member of the mafia, his fellow bandits immediately unleash a campaign pressuring the victims, witnesses, judges, public accessors. And they do this quite freely. Clearly, the criminals are more inventive than the lawmakers." Perhaps the constituency that has been most stunned by the course of Russia since the collapse of the old regime is the liberal intelligentsia. The array of writers, artists, academics, and journalists who were at the forefront of the perestroika era. For centuries, Russian intellectuals had been a kind of shadow government, a moral prod to the czars and later the Communist Party. When Pushkin stood up to the czar, or Sakharov to the general secretary, they were asserting a belief in the power of truth and the individual against a brutal system. For years, American writers like Philip Roth would return from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, marveling at the importance of literature there. Roth once remarked that in the West, everything is permitted and nothing matters, and in the East, nothing is permitted and everything matters. Now, in the East, everything goes, and the intelligentsia matters less than it ever has. One afternoon, I went to the ramshackle offices of Znamya, the banner, which was one of the leading literary and political monthlies in the Gorbachev years, to see the deputy editor, Natalia Ivanova. I had been visiting Ivanova as a reporter on and off for 6 years, and had never known her to be so pessimistic. At first I thought it might be the fate of Znamya and the other literary magazines. Where once they sold over 1 million or more copies in the late 1980s, none now sells more than 80,000 or so. Where once the best-seller lists were filled with titles from Solzhenitsyn, Orwell, and Brodsky, they are now litanies of mass lit, Dale Carnegie, John Grisham, Latvian sex manuals. Larisa Vasilieva, a Russian pop historian, has made a fortune with Kremlin Wives, a look at the seamy world of political boudoirs in the communist era. Rex Stout may now be the most popular novelist in the country. "People want a little pleasure," one writer told me. "If they have to read about one more concentration camp, they'll die." But Ivanova was worried about more than the statistics of culture. It was inevitable, she realized, that once the regime fell, the importance and outsized popularity of serious literature would fade. "We can all accept the idea that the only people reading now are the ones who read for non-political reasons," Ivanova said. "Now you see the rise of advice columns, personal ads, Harlequin romances." "Well, that's okay. What is unexpected is the general degradation of culture and of the intelligentsia itself. Its dominant position is now held by this new class of so-called businessmen, and they have no class at all. This new bourgeoisie is mostly made up of speculators stealing from the country." Ivanova showed me the galley proofs for an article of hers called "Double Suicide." It is an angry piece in which she accuses her fellow artists and thinkers of being more interested in the course of the dollar than in moral problems, of bowing humbly before a new and vulgar image of what the Leninists once called the shining future. Where once the Russian landscape was littered with one kind of propaganda, "We are marching toward Leninism," etc., television, radio, and the newspapers are now filled with a propaganda of a different order. Advertisements for unaffordable luxuries, fantastic commercials geared toward lives that hardly exist. One minute you are Homo Sovieticus, surrounded by the aggressive blandness of communism. The next minute you are watching a Slavic vixen sucking on a maraschino cherry and telling you which casino to visit. There is something profoundly irritating, and American, about ads for investment funds or premium cat food in a country where the vast majority live in poverty. A year or two of exposure to American-style commercials has produced what decades of communist propaganda could not: genuine indignation on the part of honest people against the excesses of capitalism. But the intelligentsia is bewildered by it all and incapable of providing moral guidance. "They struggled for a new life, and it turned out that this life deceived them," Ivanova said sadly. For the young, there is just no sense, no prestige, in pursuing intellectual life. At Moscow State University, it is suddenly a cinch to gain admission to the humanities department. Everyone wants to learn finance. The endless ethereal conversations around the kitchen table, the wonderful no-show jobs at academic institutes, the huge audiences for poetry readings, that world is dwindling. What we had under Gorbachev and for the years before was like the ecological system in Australia before the English brought their dogs and rabbits, another friend, the political scientist Andrei Kortunov, said. We had this weird, authentic, original kind of culture. The intellectuals were even a privileged class. But when the English came with their dogs and rabbits, the ecological system decayed. I suppose we need to go through this period of consumerism and pop culture, just as they are in Poland and Czechoslovakia. The question is whether Russia will ever be able to preserve even part of the old ecology, its distinctive intellectual character. One night I took Leonid Radzikovsky, the journalist, to dinner at the plush Italian restaurant in the Kempinski, a new German-owned hotel across from the Kremlin. When I asked him about the lost world of the Russian intelligentsia, he betrayed no wistfulness. "I am a cynic, maybe, a realist," he said. "But there is no more moral authority in Russia. Russia is a country in the stage of primitive accumulation of capital. Look around you at this restaurant. What will dinner cost? At least $100, right? An average Moscow salary for a month. In the 19th century, there were landlords and peasants and no thought of mixing them. But now everyone thinks he has a right to have dinner at the Kempinski. And everyone wants it. This is all anyone thinks about. They don't think about novels or plays or poetry. If it is true that everything in America is about dollars, it is even more true now in Russia. This is a hungry country, and it wants to be fed. A while after returning from Moscow, I traveled up to Cavendish, the small town in Vermont where Alexander Solzhenitsyn has lived in exile for 18 years. When I visited him, he had just finished his life's work, the massive historical novel The Red Wheel, and was preparing to return at last, in May 1994, to Russia. The house was filled with packing crates. His wife, Natalia, was frantically trying to find a mover that could ship all their books and papers to Moscow without losing anything. A fax came from Moscow with more troubling news. The roof on their new house on the outskirts of the city was damaged and would have to be repaired at great expense. "All the same, we can't wait to go home," Natalia Solzhenitsyn said over lunch in the kitchen. "Our minds are already back in Russia. It's as if we are no longer here in this house we have lived in for so long." There are two adjacent houses on the property, and Natalia led me to the smaller one, where Solzhenitsyn has worked 14 and 16 hours a day, without a day off since the family moved to Cavendish in 1976. He sat at a small table in his study, his face a kind of living photograph of a 19th-century man. But while his beard and Asiatic eyes are reminiscent of Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn is a man of the Russian 20th century. He, more than anyone, more even than Sakharov, made it impossible for the West to ignore any longer the true nature of the Soviet regime. If literature has ever changed the world, his books surely have. One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich opened the world of the camps up to the people of the Soviet Union in the early 60s, and the three volumes of the Gulag Archipelago erased all lingering doubts in the 70s. We talked for the better part of the day, and Solzhenitsyn spent much of the time criticizing Gorbachev, whom he dismisses, for running in place year after year, and Yeltsin, whom he admires, for letting so many millions of Russians fall far below the poverty line. What was strange to me was that Solzhenitsyn never betrayed a moment's pleasure in the victory that he, after all, had done so much to bring on, the fall of the communist regime. In August 1991, my wife and I were incredibly excited to watch on television as Dzerzhinsky's statue was taken down in front of the KGB. "That, of course, was a great moment for us," he said. But I knew inside that this was not yet true victory. I knew how deeply communism had penetrated into the fabric of life. And what were we doing? What was Yeltsin doing? We forgot everything and just fought each other. The same even now. All is decay. It's too early to celebrate. Why was I silent for so long about Gorbachev? Well, thank God something did begin, but everything was begun so badly. So what do you do, celebrate or weep? It is too early to celebrate. I just could not have gone over to Moscow in August 91 and had a glass of champagne in front of the White House with Yeltsin. The heart is not yet joyful. What he hopes for now, he said, was not a new empire, not the resuscitation of a great power, but simply the development of a normal country. It was time to join in that process. After a life that had reflected the agonies of the old regime, a communist youth, the war, prison, the camps, the battle with the Kremlin, forced exile, now at the age of 75, he was completing the circle. He had tickets to return home. "Even at the worst times, I knew I would be coming home," he said. "It was crazy. No one believed it. But I knew I would come home to die in Russia." David Remnick, January 1994. Acknowledgements. The last generation of foreign reporters in the Soviet Union was the luckiest. We were witnesses to a singular triumphant moment in a tragic century. What's more, we could describe it. We could talk to the players, major and minor, with relatively little fear of jeopardizing anyone's freedom. In the past, journalists, historians, and diplomats writing about Russia and the Soviet Union were always wary about acknowledging their friends and sources. It is with a great sense of relief and promise that I feel freed of that constriction. During my time in the twilight of the Soviet Union, I had occasion to interview hundreds of people, some repeatedly and for many hours, some for just a little while in a Kremlin corridor or on a park bench. At first, there were the old risks. I remember meeting the Ukrainian human rights defender, Bogdan Horin, in a park in Lvov, the better not to be overheard or arrested. By the time I was preparing to leave for New York, I was interviewing Bogdan in the independent Ukrainian parliament, of which he was a prominent member. The greatest source of my education in Moscow was the friendship of those who let me and my wife, Esther Fine, and our son, Alex, into their homes and lives. They were much more than sources of information. Masha Lipman, a superb translator and reporter, worked tirelessly for the Washington Post and on behalf of this book. I was lucky to count her as a friend, and to have her wise counsel, her sharp eye for the fatuous and the absurd. Masha's husband, Seryozha Ivanov, is a friend and guide through the academic and historical forests. The other members of the Gang of Four, Masha Volkenstein and Igor Primakov, were good friends and teachers. Thanks also to Grisha Kozarski and Leola Kantor, Judith and Emmanuel Lurie, Edward Gladkov, Misha and Flora Litvinov, and many others. The press corps in Moscow was superb, and I want to thank some of my friends among them, Frank Kleins, Bill Keller and Ann Cooper, Jeff and Gretchen Trimble, Chan and Jane Smiley, Eileen O'Connor and John Bilota, Jonathan Sanders, Laurie Hayes and Fenn Montaigne, Marco Politi, and, at the Post, Eleanor Randolph, Gary Lee, Fred Hyatt, and Margaret Shapiro. My main running mate and bureau chief at the Post, Michael Dobbs, was indispensable, both as a friend and as a colleague. Lisa Dobbs showed my own family constant friendship just as surely as she showed Moscow the meaning of free enterprise. A number of scholars, both in the United States and in Russia, were of great help. Among them, Richard Pipes, Stephen Cohen, Arseniy Roginsky, Leonid Batkin, and Natalia Ivanova. At the Washington Post, a raft of editors supported my work in Moscow, and I am especially grateful to Michael Gettler, David Ignatius, and the wizard Jeffrey Frank for their advice and editing as the copy flowed in. Thanks also to Ben Bradley, Leonard Downey, Robert Kaiser, Don Graham, and Catherine Graham for giving me one of the best jobs in journalism the century could offer. At my new home, The New Yorker, I am grateful first to Robert Gottlieb and Pat Crow for publishing an early piece of the book, and then to Tina Brown and Rick Hertzberg for making the arrangement permanent. Barbara Epstein invited me to write for the New York Review of Books while I was still in Moscow, and has showered me with kindness, superb editing, and Federal Express packages ever since. Barbara, Jeff Frank, Masha Lipman, and Seryozha Ivanov read the manuscript with great care and insight. I am also grateful to the Council on Foreign Relations for making me its Edward R. Murrow Fellow in 1991-92, which gave me the time, the room, and the quiet in which to work. At Random House, Jason Epstein's intelligence, wit, and skillet are all matchless. My agent, Kathy Robbins, is the source of endless patience and wise counsel. Early on, Linda Healy also gave me some very good editorial advice. I received great support from family and friends before, during, and after my time in Moscow. My parents gave me the go-ahead to move to the motherland. I am in awe of their strength and forever grateful for their unquestioning love and support. My brother Richard and sister-in-law Lisa Fernandez, as well as my grandmother Miriam Siegel, were just as helpful. And to them much thanks and love. Esther's parents, Miriam and Hyman Fine, let me take their daughter off to a terrifying place for them, and then they visited us there. They are a joy. Steve Fisher helped in the mysteries of the computer. Eric Lewis and Elise Hoffman, Richard Brody and Maya Nikolic, Mark Fisher and Jody Goodman, Michael Spector and Alessandra Stanley, and Henry Allen were all friends indeed, even at such a great distance. My son, Alexander Benjamin, named for great-grandfathers born in the last empire, was a little late getting to the show. He was born smack in the middle of the 28th and final Congress of the Communist Party. But when he did arrive, he took Moscow by storm. Our second son, Noah Samuel, came later still. I only hope that one day both Alex and Noah will visit a democratic and prosperous Russia. My greatest thanks are to Esther, who ran off to Russia with me. A strange and wonderful way to begin a marriage. In Moscow, she wrote a string of elegant features and news stories for the New York Times, visited some of the stranger corners of the empire, and delighted the competition all the while. Back in New York, she was the manuscript's keenest editor, and its author's sustenance. This book is not only for Esther, it is also very much hers. This concludes the reading of Lenin's Tomb by David Remnick. This book was read by Michael Pritchard. Copyright 1993-1994 by David Remnick. This recording of the full-length reading of Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire, was published by arrangement with the author and was produced in 2001 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.